course, he publishes the weekly Watchdog Report. He's been a contributor on this program for over 14 years, I believe. Dan, what do you make of this year's legislative session so far from Tallahassee?
First, Joe, good to be back. You know, there's two things. One, you have the big ethics push by Senate President Getz and House Speaker Weatherthal, and we'll see how that actually, how that gets through the actual legislative session. But the bigger issue is there's a real debate going on as far as the actual budget and what revenues are coming in. But this current year, we had a $69.9 billion state budget. Governor Scott suggesting a little over $74 billion. And the question is, while the state's coffers and the economy has picked up, and there is they are running ahead, with sequester coming in on the federal side, it's hard. It's giving legislators pause about what will be cut from the federal side. If it goes on for how long? How long will those cuts, and will they start to widen out? And could that push the state's economy, which is in its coming back activity, could it slow it down, which would then depress the revenues even more? So there's a couple of big, almost philosophical debates of what is the state going to do and how much money is out there right at the present time.
And what will the sequester affect mostly? Will it be social programs?
Community development block grants, Jackson, or all the public hospitals will be impacted by it. I mean, in the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. This isn't small numbers. Medicare and Medicaid is going to be, could be impacted by that. What about the military bases? We have Florida has a large concentration. The military is very important. If they start putting out, furloughs or reducing or starting to look at closing bases, what would that impact?
The local economies,
right,
of course.
Right. And the longer sequester goes on, the deeper, obviously, some of these non-surgical cuts will really start to dig in.
A lot of people don't realize how much influence the majority leaders in both the state House and Senate have. Give us a little rundown on Don Getz and Will Weatherford. They're from rural areas of Florida.
Right, and Getz has an interesting history because he was a former elected school superintendent. I believe he was a county commissioner. So he has a different kind of touch than some of the regular legislators who hadn't had that experience, that local level experience. And what has shocked him over the years is in his own county, I think it's Osceola, perhaps, the county commissioner has been arrested, is in federal prison. The sheriff's gone; he's in prison. I mean, his comment was, we're a small county, and yet, we've got, quite a number of people being arrested. So it shows in his mind that it's, it's an endemic and what has been known as the culture of corruption that surrounds a grand jury statewide did it, and they came up with that. That tag, and it's out there. I mean, you can go to Central, North, South Florida. Corruption in a lot of ways is very rampant.
Our telephone number, excuse me, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Now, that's our call-in line to be on Topical Currents if you have a comment or question about anything we're talking about. If you want to make the pledge and support public radio, and most especially support Topical Currents and regional and local programming, that number is 1-866-247-9576. Or you can also pledge the easy way online. That's WLRNradio.org. Dan, let's get into this Jennifer Carroll Lieutenant Governor resignation, her role in this Internet Cafe scandal, and this business that legislators have been serving as consultants and lobbyists just seems to really invite corruption.
Well, this is, it's a citizen legislature. As a state house rep, I think she gets $28,000 a year. As a senator, I think it's like $32,000. So most people have to have outside income. In her case, she had a PR firm, and she was doing PR for this Veterans for Victory of Florida, a not-for-profit that was supposed to be using this these gaming cafes, these internet cafes, where you can't get money, but you can get something. And the theory was they were legal, that this money was going into this veterans organization, when in fact only 3% or 2%, strike that, of some $300 million that had been raised was actually going to the veterans. And it's an FDLE probe, but, I mean, they picked up people all over the United States. So you had the FBI and federal law enforcement involved as well.
Now, this particular nonprofit organization didn't have any involvement in Broward, Dade, or Monroe counties, but everyone knows how prevalent these things are. I live in Northwest Miami-Dade County, and these people are playing these things in the food stores incessantly.
Right.
And they're spending so much time doing it. They're not doing it for entertainment
originally
purposes.
It was for Chuck E. Cheese, so they in McDonald's and Burger King, so they could have little peel-away games where, you know, you win a new second Big Mac or something. And the internet cafes drove a truck through this loophole. And there was a question, was it legal or illegal? The Florida legislature, where the organization, with many of the legislators getting a fair amount of campaign contributions from these internet cafe companies. Also, a couple of years ago, there was one or two legislators that actually owned internet cafes. So, you know, you had a situation where now everyone's shocked.
But they're calling them internet cafes. Most of these things are food stores and little, like 7-Eleven kind of things.
Right. Well, and
I don't mean to mention a specific brand, but
right. And it was also a job creator. I mean, this is it's kind of a strange, convoluted logic, but it was a way to, even though the state really doesn't get anything from it,
and a way for low income people to lose more money.
Perhaps. You know, is it gambling or isn't it?
No.
But everyone suddenly has this, you know, let's reform, let's clarify the law, let's close this. I think it's funny that it takes some.
That was a big deal in the Hialeah mayoral race,
right?
Recently, too,
in the city of Miami, and it's finally the legislators are going to do something about it, because there's clearly a question of its legality and the way the statute was written.
Now, I read recently in the local newspapers that Governor Scott's vetting team told the governor that Carroll was a, quote, live wire and was prone to some behavior that might be not what the governor wants to have out there.
This isn't the
especially
first.
Especially the office tryst business.
Well, there's that aspect. But the more the more substantial one was when she ran up $300,000 in expenses for her travels around the state. The lieutenant governor, their job is to be seen and not particularly heard. You know, when Brogan, Lieutenant Governor Brogan, resigned to take a university position, you had Tony Jennings, the former Senate president,
right.
take over.
Right.
And, you know, she was a safe choice. Scott, at this point, has a real challenge. Governor Scott has to find someone that is not only perhaps politically appealing, because he's got the race in 2014 and he's facing a fair amount of headwind, and he's not the greatest campaigner himself, but he needs someone that's also very safe. He cannot sustain. He's gone through three chiefs of staff. He's had high turnover over the last 2 years of his own in the administration. And, you know, his one really direct choice is his lieutenant governor. He's got to really vet this person.
We're speaking with regular contributor Dan Ricker. He's the publisher of the weekly Watchdog Report. You can get it by email for free. We'll be back with more topical currents. We're going to take a break and be right back. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with regular contributor Dan Ricker. He publishes the Watchdog Report each and every week by email. Dan, for those listeners who want to get up to date on South Florida politics and government, that's
the place all they to have to do is go to, you know, type in either Watchdog Report or watchdogreport.net, and it comes right up. UM built the webpage. They did a great job. And
it's free.
And it's free. No ads, nothing.
It's mailed out every Sunday evening.
And on Sunday at about 4 o'clock. This past week, I didn't write because I was in the process of raising my own money.
Tell me, Dan, we've talked a little bit about state governor and the state legislature, state government. What about the political future of Governor Rick Scott and possible reelection next year? And also, do you see any strong Democratic statewide candidates?
You know, the Democrats have an incredible ability to run a presidential campaign and capture Florida, as we just saw with Obama. But when it comes to the off-year races, they've really had a tough time. You know, they had Bill McBride. You had candidates. You know, Rick Scott ran against Alex Sink, who was the CFO of the state, but, you know, a couple months before the actual election, something like 20-25% of the voters thought Alex was actually a guy, though she's a woman. And, you know, it right now there is, you know, Charlie Crist is floating out there. He's done his transformation from Republican to independent to now Democrat. People have said, well, how about if he...
I guess he would be the strongest opponent.
Right. How about if he teamed up with someone like Dan Gelber, who was the former majority leader of the in the House...
very liberal.
Yeah, liberal and a former federal prosecutor. You know, Scott, the thing is, people at this point, 4 years into Governor Scott's term, they know what they got. I mean, in 2010, when he ran, he spent $73 million of his own money. He was able to defeat not only Bill McCollum, who has been a perennial Republican in the primaries, but he ran a pretty devastating campaign against Sink, and now people know him. You know, as one very insider up in Tallahassee said, "Well, the great experiment is over and it's a failure," and that was like a year ago. But you know, Scott's also tacking more to the center.
He's mellowed a little bit.
He's mellowed. He's a shy guy. I mean, I sat and watched him for over an hour in a Sedano's food store down here packing Goya products. Who knew they had 3,000 different products? And you had, you know, elderly Cuban-American women with their little shopping cart coming down the aisle, and they don't know who he is. And, you know, they would kind of just, you know, someone almost say, you know, can, you know, get out of the way.
He's a very striking figure.
Yeah, but he's also, you know, there's a shyness to him. And I've heard that from other people that have spent more time with him. But, you know, he's on a find out like this year. He may have wanted to give all the teachers around the state $2,500 as an incentive bonus, et cetera. But he's run smack into the Florida legislature that's saying, what are you, crazy? You know, we got to have it. Not everyone deserves something like that. There's got to be based on performance.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. That's the call-in line. Our pledge line, by the way, is 1-866-247-9576. Michael in Miami, hi.
Hey, it's Mike. Mike here. How are you guys?
Good.
Well, I'm native here from Miami, born in Miami, and, you know, I care a lot about Miami and Florida. It's a ripoff down here, the way that they're the government's doing, you know, the government of Miami is doing so much money. You got projects in every corner of the street in Miami worth, they put like a big sign, and they say, well, this project's worth about $700,000. You walk a few blocks down, another little project worth about $500,000. You walk another block down, another little project worth about $1 million. You know, this is happening left and right. And I don't know who owns Miami. Miami looks like the movie The Untouchables. You see these guys stealing money and all that. Tomas Regalado from Miami, he has a bodyguard. He pays him about $100,000+. And all these guys are commissioners. They get brand new trucks to run around, and they get like a full gas tank to get all these privileges.
Dan, you spend a lot of time at County Hall.
I mean, who's doing something about this?
Sir?
I mean, it's a ripoff. I mean, if you walk around Miami,
sir,
and then you got Medicaid fraud, and every corner of Miami you got like this Medicaid clinic.
Sir?
I mean, who's doing something about this?
Okay. First of all, a lot of that construction...
You walk around Miami, and then you got Medicaid fraud.
Well, a lot of the...
You had a speaker on there.
Okay. A lot of the stuff that you're seeing, especially in the city of Miami or Miami Beach, in the case of the city of Miami, There's the 2001 Homeland Defense bonds, which was $245 million of infrastructure-type projects that the city of Miami needed. And that's, you're seeing some of that. But the big enchilada is the $2.9 billion county GOB bond that was passed in 2004.
Government obligation bond.
Right. And that's funding a lot of these municipal projects on Miami Beach, through all 34 municipalities throughout Dade County. And, you know, to his question about the sergeant of arms and everything else, it is an expense. I question sometimes, the need for it to, there's certain activities, yes. Other activities, I think some of this, the sergeants and some of the law enforcement use is overblown.
Getting back to state government, we have emailer who wants to know how the sequester will be affecting Florida Medicaid.
It almost remains to be seen. I don't have a crystal ball, but it's going to definitely affect it. And I mean, you had Scott trying to expand the pool by an extra 3 million patients, or strike that, an extra million patients. There's already 3 million in Medicaid. This is a moving target because you also have Obamacare, or you also have the Affordable Care Act kicking in. So this is part of the dilemma. So we have sequester, we have a state budget that's doing better than it ever was or had been in for the last 6 years, but yet you've got these other variables coming in on the federal side, and will it slow down that growth? This is a real dilemma.
Are they on top of this at the Public Health Trust, which runs, of course, Jackson Hospital?
Well, I mean, to be honest, if you look at Jackson, if you had said 3 years ago what was the prognosis, it was very grim. You know, it was almost terminal cancer. They've stopped the hemorrhaging. They're running a slight positive balance per month. But the problem is they only have 13 days of cash on hand. Most hospitals will have 175, 200 days of cash on hand.
But if there's less Medicaid being paid out, then are they going to really take it on the chin with their emergency room?
I think it's like $140 million hit, potentially. Because it also, combined with the Affordable Care Act, they're not going to take out the disproportionate share program and some of the other programs where federal money is drawn down and then distributed among the public hospitals throughout the state. That program's going to go away. So you add that and what the legislature might do, it's big challenges. And in the future, they would love to somehow get voters to agree to maybe a $400 or $400 million GOB bond for their infrastructure. The actual infrastructure, Jackson, it needs attention. It's very dated.
We're speaking with regular contributor Dan Ricker. Of course, he publishes the Watchdog Report, which is published every Sunday via email, and it's also free. Where else but on public radio would you hear this kind of programming, in-depth news, public affairs? I think you should support our regional local programming, and we're going to take a break and tell you how to do so. Topical Currents, Monday edition. My guest is Dan Ricker of the Watchdog Report. How do they get on the list, Dan?
Just email me at publisher@watchdogreport.net or go online at watchdogreport.net or just Google Watchdog Report and it comes right up. I'm first in about 51 million hits.
As we just heard on the last break, we're getting very close to that $4,000 goal. We would hate to leave any money on the table. When we get to $4,000, that your pledge is doubled. So please, if you're thinking about it, if you're sitting on the fence, now's the time to hop off and give us a call at 1-866-247-9576. Dan Ricker, something we've covered over the years. I remember talking with my colleague Tony Doris about this 14, 15 years ago. This shrink wrap business at Miami-Dade Airport.
Who knew?
Miami International Airport. Is it really that lucrative to be dabbling like this?
Well, it's $7 to $9 million a year that the county gets, so that's a subset of the actual revenue.
These are international travelers who have
the bags. You got to understand, in the late 90s, they had they tried some beta sites where they were doing this, and the big contract for it the first time was in 2000, and it was a riot. The place, the county commission, I still have the video of it. County commission was packed with lobbyists, both sides. It went on for 4 hours. In the middle of it, Robert Holland, who was one of the top lobbyists, you know, declared that Merritt Sternheim, the manager of Miami-Dade County at the time, was a racist. Merritt denied it. But the best part was a half-hour subset where the lobbyists were arguing was because the contract had ultimately gone to a hearing judge. And was the hearing judge awake, dozing, or full asleep? And, I mean, I'm sitting there.
Didn't it wind up not going to the low bidder?
Yeah, right. And it went with another company. And I was thinking at the time, all I want, because it's a cash deal, is a camera looking down on that so we can see where the money, the actual cash, is going. Now, since then, it evolved. You had 911, which changed the whole dynamics. But MIA accounts for almost 90% of all the shrink wrap bags in the nation. So it's in, it's for the flights going to South America. And so it's a big business down here. But it's just what's funny is, as you opened up, what could be essentially a fairly innocuous contract suddenly becomes this major brawl that just had County Mayor Carlos Jimenez vetoing the 9-2 vote, or vetoing what the commission passed, which was a 9-2 vote. And depending on who else is there when it comes back, we'll see if that veto gets overridden.
Let's touch on Dolphin Stadium upgrades in the neighborhood of $400 million, and it's going to go before voters. Maybe it's just the circle I run in, but I know of no one really that supports that project, except maybe on sports talk radio, the diehard fans.
Yeah, it's, you know, for a lot of people, it's difficult for them to understand why Stephen Ross, who's worth $4.4 billion or whatever it is, why we need to tax or take tourist tax money and get, and why the Dolphins should get these tax breaks
from the mainland,
from the mainland. And you know, the real issue is, for many voters, is one, they want to see the deal. I've sat in now on a couple of the team's presentations to local groups, and one in Coral Gables, and you know, the people had the same question: what's the final deal before I'm gonna make any kind of decision. The other thing is, in the back of everyone's mind, is the Florida Marlins Stadium. And while the team, the NFL, and the Dolphins want to separate the two, unfortunately, here in South Florida, they are together. And with the Marlins, we've had poor attendance. We've had the team being gutted. And this is the thing. I could have lived with some of the other stuff, but the thing that sends me over the top is the fact that over the time of the bonds that were used to finance the construction of the $550 million stadium with the roof, it finances out to almost $2.5 billion. We cannot prepay. We can't close out the loan any earlier. All the big payments, all the payments are pretty much on the back end of the bonds. It was a terribly financed deal. And to have that stadium, I mean, every child born today.
And the Dolphins haven't been in the playoffs in a decade.
Right. Well, in the case of the Marlins, that's what's driving and has tainted a lot of the water. And while I think the Dolphins have a greater loyalty by their fans, they're having to deal with that headwind.
So the mayor and the commissioners, they don't want to be slammed like they were after they agreed to the Marlins deal,
right,
without having it go to a referendum.
Right. And that's the question. I mean, polls done with Dario Moreno at FIU, you know, shows what, 72-73% of the voters were against it. So they got some real selling to do.
Last week we had a Miami-Dade school board meeting. What interested you in that?
Well, I think Alberto Carvalho, the superintendent, you know, they finally gave him a little bump, but it was being construed by some in the media. And I thought I had done a story. It's online right now. Mine was a little more balanced in the sense that people were asking me, is he going to go for a $400,000 figure? And I said, absolutely not. He's on a keep it non-controversial. He's not, he's high profile. My God, he's practically a rock star status within the community. But he's not going to take advantage. I mean,
he
gave,
also
I mean,
heads,
he gave up 50,000.
He's the biggest organization
right,
in the county.
He gave up 50,000 a year in perks already. And what'll happen is, I suspect he'll get. He said he'd take the median of the teachers' raises. He'll take that number, maybe throw in a couple of perks, but I doubt it would be much over $300,000. So,
how about?
And you're right. It's the largest public organization here. I mean, the mayor. I mean,
public or private.
Yeah, and if you look at his executives, they're paid a lot less than a lot of the county, Miami-Dade County executives.
How about news from Broward? It seems like I keep reading about that Broward seems to be the identity theft capital of the state. A lot of stories on.
Well, it's from Palm Beach South. I mean, I run all the federal, a lot of the federal and state identity stuff. I mean, I had Fernandez Rundle tell me a couple of weeks ago, my God, this thing is just insane how the volume has picked up. I mean, if you have a choice between, you know, doing selling drugs or something other illicit thing versus identity theft, where you don't have to worry about a turf war or someone, you know, I mean, it's a pretty benign as far as the actual execution of it. It's not, you know, even though it's violent to the person whose identity has been taken, in the sense that their life becomes a nightmare.
And people are particularly vulnerable around income tax time.
Right, where people are filing early for people's refunds. And suddenly, Senator Nelson...
They get your Social Security number somehow,
right.
and file a return.
And they're off to the races. And Senator Nelson had a woman a couple of years ago, Mrs. X, who, she recounted her 18-month ordeal trying to get it straight with the IRS. And it was, you know, I mean, this is a real nightmare for people because it kills your credit rating. It really, your life is turned upside down.
And how about quickly an update on the Public Health Trust in about a minute or so?
Hanging in there. The wait time in the ER is now down to 2 hours. It used to be 12, 18, whatever.
Oh, heavens.
Though the ER is the most expensive place to present if you do have a medical problem. But it's, you know, Carlos Magoya, the banker, has been able to kind of get fashion agreements with the unions. The biggest thing is the role in the future is the role of what will University of Miami Miller Medical School, what service will they be providing, and what services will Jackson be doing on their own as far as, you know, different lines of medicine? Because they're changing and it's an evolving relationship, and it's not this, what we used to have was like a blanket annual operating agreement where you just had a number and they provided. Now it's much more detailed. And so that's the question is both UM and Jackson are trying to figure out and, you know, fashion their future and the strategy for the future.
Well, I certainly want to thank you, Dan Ricker, always informative. Dan Ricker publishes the Watchdog Report every week, of course. And you're listening to Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break and then come back and close. And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Online producer is Paul Leary. Our pledge line, will you help us out? It's 1-866-247-9576 or online support at WLRNradio.org. And tomorrow it's our popular members-only edition with Bonnie Berman and our faithful listener members. Will that member be you? And to the calendar. On this day, 1926, 87 years ago, the birth of actor Peter Graves in Minneapolis. Fury, Stalag 17, Mission Impossible, Airplane, and A&E's biography. And on this day in 1932, 81 years ago, the birth of writer John Updike in Reading, Pennsylvania. His Rabbit series is a literary classic. He wrote hundreds of stories, poems, and reviews in The New Yorker and won a Pulitzer Prize in 1982. One more while we relish warm cinnamon rolls. On this day in 1961, 52 years ago, the birth of the anthropoid character Poppin' Fresh, the Pillsbury Doughboy. The Doughboy has starred in some 600 commercials. His original Doughboy voice was done by the great Paul Frees. Make that pledge. Support Topical Currents. 1-866-247-9576. We leave with a thought from John Updike, famous as the chronicler of suburban adultery. Quote, "We do survive every moment after all, except the last one." This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for The Talk of the Nation from NPR News.